This podcast is generously sponsored by the Pillar Network. The Pillar Network is a community of SBC and International Baptist churches that are doctrinally aligned, missionally driven, and committed to equipping, planting, and revitalizing churches together. If you're a pastor of an established church and you're desiring to lead your congregation to plant churches, but you're not sure how to get started, Pillar could be a great resource for you. Reach out to them today at thepillarnetwork.com. Thepillarnetwork.com.
Baptist 21 is a pastor-led voice for Southern Baptists in the 21st century. The B21 podcast will discuss current issues in the SBC with Southern Baptist church leaders. To check out more resources, visit us at baptist21.com.
Well, welcome to the Baptist 21 podcast, where we want to have conversations about what it means to be Baptist in the 21st century, and that certainly always entails all things SBC, and we're just a couple of months out from a Southern Baptist convention in Nashville. I would say, Lord willing, with everything that's going on, maybe it gets moved. We don't know. There's some other things up in the air right now, but that certainly entails the election of the Southern Baptist Convention president, and so I have with me today Pastor Mike Stone. Pastor Mike Stone's name will be nominated there in Nashville or wherever we meet. And so, Pastor Stone, thanks so much for taking time to be on the podcast.
Man, it's a blessing to be with you guys.
Awesome. Well, tell us just briefly, I want folks to get to know you that may not know you that well. Give just a quick background of testimony. How did you come to know and love the Lord? Maybe even just kind of how did you work your way through calling to ministry, any ministry training, and how did you get to Emmanuel?
Yeah, the very short version is I was raised in a Christian home, and my parents were the kind of parents that were praying over me while I was still in the womb and carried to church 9 months before I was born. My parents raised me in a Pentecostal, traditional Pentecostal denomination. And around the ninth grade, I actually came to Christ in a regular Sunday night service when I was 8 years old, just a simple gospel message. I couldn't tell you the first time I ever heard the gospel, just raised where it was a regular part of our family conversation and our family life. My dad served as a deacon in that church. We were there Sunday morning, Sunday night. Thursday night is when we had our midweek study. And then my parents sang in a gospel group. So we were usually at an all-night gospel sing on Friday night, Saturday night, those kinds of things. So just immersed in the traditional Pentecostal background, came to Christ at an early age. But in the ninth grade, our youth ministry, very, very small congregation, but the student ministry was studying the book of Ephesians. And when I ran into chapter two, I kind of wrestled with some of my own church's understanding of the doctrines of salvation. I didn't know the word soteriology at that time, but obviously that's what I was dealing with, very much from an Arminian background. And I know now that I was saved when I was eight, but especially during middle school, I thought I got saved several times a day, sinful thoughts, sinful words, and I would feel that I'd lost my salvation. Mm-hmm. But it was during that time, ninth grade, I really started wrestling with what some of the church of my upbringing, for which I'm very grateful. I want to go on record for that. Thank God for my parents and the way that they raised me. But I came to have some difference of opinion and difference of doctrine, what my church was teaching. Ironically, the next year when I was in 10th grade, we were studying the book of 1 Corinthians, and we got over to chapters 12, 13, and 14, and I just had a different understanding of what my church believed about various aspects of spiritual gifts, and I'm not angry about that or upset about it, but I just had a difference of belief and opinion about that. My parents wanted me to remain in their church under their convictions until I graduated from high school. So I submitted to that. Yeah. Simultaneous with this, about the 10th grade, I really sensed what I believed to be a vocational call on my life. But Nate, I was raised in a church that if there were more than 25 people, it was either Easter or homecoming. So the vocational call that I sensed, I thought that would be what we would probably call now a bivocational or even a volunteer ministry position. Wow. I was very musically active. I was in the band at school. My band director was a kind of a very influential person on campus, similar to a high school football coach. And thank God for our coaches and those ministries they have on the campus. So I reasoned in my mind that the vocational call was to be a high school band director and leverage that position for the sake of the gospel. And so that has continued to be a part of my teaching and preaching ministry, encouraging people in all occupations to leverage that position for the cause of Christ. But I entered undergraduate school preparing to be a music minister. And by that time, having graduated from high school, My parents allowed me to visit the church of my conviction, and I didn't know a Unitarian Universalist from a Lutheran, from an Independent Baptist, right. from a Southern Baptist, literally just had no background in that regard. Landed by God's grace in a wonderful Southern Baptist congregation in South Georgia, received what I believe to be a scriptural baptism at that point, mm-hmm. and heard about things like the cooperative program, which I thought was the greatest thing since sliced bread. My pastor in that church was a full-time pastor, and we had a full-time minister of music and youth. So my terminology of the idea of just having full-time vocational ministry in a church setting, I came to understand that that was even a possibility. Through that, I continued to think God was calling me into a different profession. And so I thought at that time, maybe it was law school to be an attorney, and entered law school at Mercer University. And during my first year of law school, God just really confirmed in my life that it was a church vocational ministry. I always like to point out, I was not running from God's call. I was doing my best to run toward it. Yeah. But God was using these situations in his providence to get me to, geographically even to where I believe he wanted me to be. While I was in law school, I didn't come out with a JD, but I did come out with a wife that I met while I was in Macon. Went to Mercer Law School that first year and met my wife. She and her family were from the Macon area, and I just happened to attend, in God's providence, just happened to attend the church where she and her family were actively involved. When I surrendered to the vocational ministry, I did that on a Sunday service, and just a couple of weeks later, my minister of music announced his resignation to go take a church out in New Mexico. My pastor said to me at that time, you need the experience and I need an interim. And so this seems like a match made in heaven, so to speak. So I went on staff at that church as the interim minister of music and stayed for 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, they removed the interim title after about 3, maybe 4 months. And then this fall will be 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. I came as the minister of music to the church that I serve now, served there for 5.5 years in that capacity. When my pastor left to go to North Georgia to take another church, I told our pulpit committee to find a pastor that wanted a wanted to bring his music minister with him, because I was going to be going with the former pastor.
Wow.
I felt God had that's a frequent thing that happens with a pastor and a staff member. Right. And I really thought that was what God was going to be doing. 4 months into that transition, God had just so radically changed my own heart and calling. The church extended a unanimous call Father's Day weekend. So I'm coming up on my 25th anniversary overall at Emmanuel Baptist here in South Georgia, but I will soon hit my 19th anniversary as the senior pastor. And the Lord's just been good and gracious through the ministry here.
So music minister to lead teaching pastor, that's not normally the route that people go. Do you still sing sometimes in your sermons or no?
I find myself quoting a lot of sermons. God has blessed me with a bit of a memory. And of course, those old hymns, they come back and really engage people, you know, emotionally. But as far as singing, I do sing sometimes more on special occasions. It's almost more of the novelty thing. You know, if it's high attendance Sunday or kickoff or revival or something like that, the pastor may sing with the choir, but it's a little bit more of a novelty act these days.
Yeah, I was closing a sermon a couple of weeks ago with Rescue the Perishing, actually Jonah 1, and I was dead set I was going to sing it, and when I got there at the end, I just quoted it. I couldn't. My voice is not that great, so I think the congregation was probably thankful for that.
Well, what's awful, this past Sunday as we record this was Easter Sunday, and I spontaneously went into the chorus of the song that I announced was one of my favorite songs. I said, this reminds me of the chorus of one of my favorite songs, and I started singing it. And got a mental block going into the fourth line. And thankfully, it just naturally came, I think, muscle memory more than anything else. Yeah. But I thought, I'm going to botch it on Easter Sunday.
That's awesome. Oh, that's awesome. Hey, before we kind of jump into more meaty questions about the SBC presidency, I like to just kind of give a chance for people to get to know you. So kind of think of, I'm going to ask you 7 quick questions, kind of answer as quick as you can. Think kind of Family Feud at the end kind of thing. So question number 1, you're a Georgia guy. Are you a Georgia Bulldog fan?
Go Dogs.
Okay, that's good. I thought we were going to have to stop the interview right there. If you 2nd question, favorite book that's not the Bible?
Favorite book that's not the Bible. Let's see. There are very many. Yep. Obviously, I like Vody Bachum's Family Driven Faith has been a real instrumental book in my life.
Oh, great. 3rd question, favorite athlete of all time? That's hilarious, because the next question was going to be Jordan or LeBron, and you answered correctly. So I appreciate that. Next question, favorite food?
Mexican food.
Yeah, oh, I'm a big fan myself. Thinking even childhood, favorite Christmas gift of all time?
I got a very expensive trumpet when I was in the 10th grade, and it's a favorite gift because I needed one, and it was a huge sacrifice for my parents.
That's awesome. I'll give you a quick story of my background. So we had to do music band in elementary school, and 50% of the grade was the concert at the end of the year, and our dad let us skip that for a baseball game, and so we got an F. And take that for what you will about my dad. So last question. First, do you remember the text of the first sermon you ever preached?
Isaiah chapter 6, Isaiah's call to ministry. Mm. And so I shared that and kind of paralleled. It was my ordination service. They asked me to bring the main message. And of course, we had the two charges to the candidate and to the church, but it was Isaiah 6.
Wow, that's awesome. Awesome. Well, let's jump into maybe some more meaty questions about the SBC presidency. Just want to start here. Why are you allowing your name to be nominated? Who's nominating you? And then, for lack of a better term, what will your platform be?
Yeah, let me deal with those just kind of in the order they're coming to my mind. The nominator has not been selected. I've got several who have offered to do that. And the biggest reason for the delay, quite frankly, is just geographically, not even knowing where the convention is going to be. Sometimes that's that can be an issue with who the nominator is. So just being very candid about that. Why I would allow my name to be placed in nomination, I do have a lot of organizational experience. I've served as the chairman of the executive committee here in Georgia, which is one of the largest state conventions in the SBC. I served as EC chairman here, as well as state convention president 2017 to 2018, was chairman of the SBC executive committee 2018 to 2020. And from that vantage point, just have grown with a more of a deep appreciation for who we are as Southern Baptists, what some of our opportunities are. I am an unapologetic lover of the Southern Baptist Convention. Often when I preach, I'll say I have SBC on my BVDs. I just love the work that we do together as Southern Baptists, and just believe that it was the call of God on my life. When I vacated the chairman's seat for the SBC Executive Committee, I really thought at that time that my ministry in that regard in denominational life had come to a conclusion, because I had no personal desire to seek out the presidency, the nomination for that. But God just really laid it on my heart in prayer and through a series of confirmations. My wife, church staff, deacons here at our church, just really affirming that potential all along the way. So there's certainly a willingness to serve in that capacity. And I'll give you the real quick bulleted version of what my emphases would be. And I'll point out, Nate, that I have a ministry website at pastormikestone.com, where with some videos and some writings, I drill down a little bit deeper onto these three items. But the first item would really be to focus on evangelism. I'm grateful for the Hoosier One initiative, and now Dr. Johnny Hunt is doing an incredible job with NAM just leading out on that across the country. Our church is a very evangelistic church. That's been one of the heartbeats and passions of my own life as a personal soul winner and as an evangelistic pastor. And but we're also seeing a continued decline in the evangelistic fruitfulness of our Southern Baptist work. Our baptisms, the last full ACR report, that's pre-COVID, of course. We know that 2020 is going to have an asterisk by it in all of our statistical data. Mm-hmm. But the last numbers that we saw have our convention-wide baptisms at their lowest level since 1939. And I really just want to, if God be pleased, to use the presidency as a platform to do what others have done in the past. I don't claim to have any uniqueness in this regard. Anybody running for president, all the way down to want to be moderator of the local Baptist Association, I believe that Baptists have a heart to see lost people saved. So again, I don't claim any singularity in that passion, but it is a passion of mine, and I'd like to lead out in an emphasis on a nationwide evangelistic emphasis. Obviously, you'd work together with NAM and other related entities and ministry partners. Secondly, and I'd be more brief, is just to help champion the sufficiency of Scripture. And thirdly, is to seek ways to foster greater involvement from Southern Baptists across the country in the missions and ministry of our Southern Baptist Convention. One quick statistic that shows some of the challenges that we have is that with 47,000 churches, that's just a round number, 47,000 churches are considered to be in cooperation with the SBC. you'd be hard pressed to get about 9,000 messengers at an annual meeting, even though every church gets two, and you can qualify for more than that. I think there are financial concerns, there are geographic concerns. Not everybody has the time, the effort, the energy, the resources to leave their local field and go to an annual meeting. But I do think that there are ways with today's technology that perhaps that we could increase involvement in the work of the Southern Baptist Convention. I just think that would bode well for our future.
So a question that was sent in by listeners. So we're going to interview all four candidates for SBC president. And one of the questions was this: you know, basically, when you're allowing yourself to be nominated alongside three other men at this point, that means in some ways, not in an arrogant sense, but in some ways you stand out as compared to the other candidates, or else you likely wouldn't run. So in your mind, kind of what makes you stand out as a candidate? And you don't have to compare yourself to the other brothers. That's not what I mean, but you understand what I'm saying as far as why you uniquely for this role?
Well, at the point that I allowed my name to be announced, Dr. Moeller was the only other announced candidate. There had been two announced candidates going into Orlando, maybe some assumption that both would be renominated. But at the time, Dr. Moeller was the only other candidate. I called him the day that my announcement was made and shared with him that it wasn't personal. I actually told him, and I don't mind sharing it even here, I listen to the briefing, if not every day. I catch up on the repeats of it when I'm on the road or doing some work around the house, and stated I probably quote him in my sermons more than any other person that I name. I actually said I probably quote John MacArthur and John Phillips more, but I quote them so much I have to just say one noted writer said, I've had appreciation for Dr. Moeller. In this particular regard, I shared with him, I just sense it's the call of God on my life, the same thing that I sense that I'm confident that he and Miss Mary had as they prayed through as husband and wife, God's call on his life to allow his name to go forward. And so that's the bottom line. I would say from an organizational perspective, I have felt since I entered into the Southern Baptist life, I felt there was a conflict between an entity head simultaneously serving as SBC president. I felt that way the last time that it happened. I was a minister of music at that time, and I asked my pastor if it wasn't it illegal in some way, you know, from a governing documents perspective, for a sitting seminary president to be SBC president at the same time. And of course, the answer to that is that is not a violation of our bylaws. But I do believe that it is a conflict of interest, and that's not a personal attack in any way whatsoever. But I do think that is one clear distinction between me and Dr. Moeller's candidacy. The other candidates, I don't know either one of them personally. I've spoken to both of them in passing. They brought their names into the nomination process after I announced mine. Don't know either of them personally to really comment in any great detail. I do know that Dr. Adams has seemed to have sort of a corruption that we need transparency, and there may be even malfeasance in some of our entities. I don't share that particular view at the level that he does. I am in favor of increased accountability and transparency, but I don't necessarily look around and find corruption at the level that I hear some people suggesting. And Dr. Ed Litton, again, I don't know him, so I really can't comment too much beyond that.
Would you rather spend your day serving in your ministry or managing your team's health plan? Let's face it, employee benefit issues can distract from your ministry agenda, but someone has to do this work. That's why your church should consider Guidestone. When you enroll your staff in a Guidestone health plan, you get more than just great benefits. You also get access to knowledgeable, quick-to-respond support team as well. Plus, their concierge service helps prevent health plan problems and finds fast answers if something does come up. See how they can serve you. Visit insurance.guidestone.org and get a quote for Guidestone Health Plan today. Again, insurance.guidestone.org to get a quick quote. That's helpful. So the purpose of the Southern Baptist Convention is to cooperate for the propagation of the gospel. I know a lot of the questions that were submitted to us were concerns around division. And so let me just ask it like this. How will you help us as a president unite around the BFNM 2000 for the propagation of the gospel, for mission? And maybe even just some follow-up questions like, how will you help us disagree without demonizing one another? I know in our convention right now, you have kind of extreme polar opposites and you have lots of groups in between. Each group has their own concerns. And I'll ask a follow-up question to this about theological triage, but how will you help us unite around the BF&M 2000 for the propagation of the gospel?
Well, the most critical way to do that, the most important way, is really just through conversation. I know that just in the last week or so, I've had some very intentional strategic conversations with some of our African-American leadership within the SBC on the national and on the state level here in Georgia. And each of those conversations has ended wonderfully, wonderfully well. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a related issue to this, Nate, and that is the Southern Baptist Convention does not and cannot exist on SBC Twitter. We cannot have that. That's not a conversation. And I have done my best, certainly in more recent days. If you've been on social media since its inception, each of us probably have things we'd like to take back, wish we had either not stated at all or said more clearly. Once we see the reaction, we know that our intention was mm-hmm. misunderstood. But 140 characters or even a thread of those is not the way to have real meaningful family dialogue. Yeah. In part because it lends itself to misunderstanding, that you can't have theological nuance on Twitter. And then you begin reacting and people are defending themselves, et cetera. That's just not the best place to have it, not only because it's ineffective and inefficient, but many of these conversations are intra-family. They're intramural conversations, and they're not best to have before an onlooking world in terms of just having it out on Twitter. I don't think that's a good look. I don't think that's a gospel look. So, but back to the specifics of your question, I think that real life conversation is the way that happens. And once you sit down and break bread, or in my case, have a good cup of coffee together, here in South Georgia, my favorite place to eat is the Huddle House. And so I will regularly say, man, if we could have this conversation over some grits and eggs and a cup of coffee at the Huddle House, I think that we would see that we agree on far more than what we disagree about. I'll dovetail into that and say, even in my own congregation, our church has a very specific stated doctrine that is even more specific on some points than the Baptist Faith and Message. And certainly with the autonomy of the local church, many, if not most of our churches have additional things that they believe internally to their own local congregation. But even with that, I have members of Emmanuel Baptist Church that do not embrace the church's position on some secondary or even tertiary matters. As a quick example, growing up in the Pentecostal background in which I was raised and my understanding coming out of that, I'm personally a cessationist, and I'm not mad with people who are not. For example, my mom and my dad are not cessationists, and they're devout followers of Jesus. They love the Lord. But I'm a cessationist, doctrinally. Our church, therefore, over the period of the last two pastorates has taken on that position as a congregation. But I have members of my church who hold a different position and would tell you they have a private prayer language. And it's not a point of contention. It's not a point of fellowship. But they understand that when I preach and when our church teaches on these particular issues, and that's just one example, there could be some others, but we're going to teach and preach what our church believes. We're not going to change it, water it down, because we're afraid you'll be bothered by it. And in our new members class, one of the things we try to point out is when those issues come along, you don't have to agree on every jot and tittle with the church, but we will be relationally, personally bothered that you're upset, maybe by a sermon or a Sunday school lesson, because you never want to offend anyone. But we're not going to be organizationally troubled to where we're revisiting our doctrinal positions every time someone says we disagree with what the church believes. So the theological triage, I think I first kind of became aware of that particular phrase through the teaching of Dr. Moeller and some of the things that he had written at that time about his own theological triage process. We embrace that here at our church. Obviously, all Christians, properly defined, believe in the fundamentals of the faith. That's why they're fundamentals. If you don't have that, you don't have biblical Christianity, and therefore you don't have a biblically based Christ follower. But I think having patience, properly putting these theological issues in the right category, I think we probably would have a lot of agreement on what the first level fundamental issues would be. But I think sometimes even within a congregation or a convention, there's debate about whether it's a second level or a third tier issue. But I do think that we We need conversations that will be much more helpful than social media. And I would seek to lead out in those conversations.
That's helpful. My version of breaking bread, going back to your favorite food, is chips and queso. So yeah, so in that vein of theological triage, because there is obviously just, we could have this conversation all day, and this is not what I intend for this conversation, but what are the, so thinking of these categories, what are the things we should divide over? So they're in the camp of, we cannot stay on the same team and still hold to these two separate ideas. And what are the things that are in the category of, okay, we can disagree and still be on the same team? Again, current cultural moment, not just anything out there under the sun. Again, we could have that conversation all day long, but just for our current cultural moment, what's kind of like, this is out of bounds, we have to divide over this. This is in bounds, we can disagree over that.
Well, I would go back to the Baptist faith and message in the sense that when you disagree on first level fundamental issues, that results in different religions. If someone denies the exclusivity of Christ, the bodily resurrection of Christ, et cetera, that's a different religion, regardless of what it calls itself. It may be pseudo-Christian, but mm-hmm. it's different. But denominations, or in our case, conventions of churches, exist because we have agreed to agree and cooperate around a certain statement of faith. And that statement of faith for us, the Baptist Faith and Message, does address second level and even what I would consider third level doctrines. For example, our belief on what believers' baptism is. And by stating what it is, we're expressing what it is not. And I've never shared the gospel and told someone that, you know, their water baptism was a part of receiving Christ. So by definition, that's a second level issue. But it is a Baptist distinctive, and we've agreed that if you're going to be in partnership, fellowship with the Southern Baptist Convention, technically, if you look at the governing documents of the convention, your church doesn't even have to embrace the Baptist faith and message.
Right.
But you have to embrace a faith and a practice that is closely aligned with, that is, it's, you know, similar to.
Right.
And for us, I think a church that may be baptized infants or accepted people without a believer's baptism would place them, in my estimation, very clearly outside of cooperation with the SBC. So I think a couple of the issues that I think there's room to disagree on, obviously the cessationism issue that I spoke of earlier. And I think we need to have a conversation to more clearly define what we embrace as a convention of churches on the complementarian versus egalitarian issue. That is something certainly in the last couple of years that I think has really, really been highlighted. Some are suggesting we need a revision of the Baptist Faith and Message to be more specific about the office and function of the pastor being limited to women. Others are opposed to that, and they see that as being more nuanced. I do think that that is a case where I don't think a church is necessarily outside of fellowship with the SBC, depending on how they flesh that out within the context of their own local church. But I do think that's something that the SBC, you know, we're going to have those conversations. I think we need to have them in a helpful way. I am a very strict complementarian. Our church is as well. And so that's where I stand on that particular issue. But that's the kind of issue that the SBC is going to have to address. And I think as we come together and find clarity on those issues, that's ultimately what leads to unity. Because unity sometimes is misused, I think, that we need to not talk about these issues that could divide us so that we can have unity. But I don't embrace as a pastor or as a denominational leader the idea that we need to sweep these disagreements under the rug for the purpose of unity. I think we need to have the conversation so that we can move forward in unity in the future.
I recently, so there's been a lot of conversation around the complementarian piece, and I recently put up a series of tweets just obviously affirming that the office of pastor, which is connected to the function of preaching, is for men only, according to the scriptures. That's been a lot of debate. And usually the pushback, and I'll just throw it out for you. You know, I had pushback on my own Twitter thread. I'll throw it out to you just to kind of hear how you would address this, is always, well, you always emphasize what women can't do. How will you in your presidency emphasize what women can do in the life, not just of the local church, but also in the life of our convention?
Well, a lot of times the reason that it's in the debate atmosphere, so to speak, whether that's social media or denominational writings, et cetera, is because some view that a woman has maybe stepped forward into a position and functioning in a way that she should not be functioning. So it's really, in my view, difficult to separate the two. I think it is a good tweet If someone says we need to focus on talking about what our sisters in Christ can do and not focus on what they cannot do, that again, I would have no problem liking or sharing or retweeting that tweet. But when a sister in Christ is doing something that we all agree the scriptures allow her to do, that never makes it to SBC Twitter. So it's usually in the atmosphere or the circumstance of a sister in Christ who is believed by some to have operated outside of that. And so the conversation almost by definition is about what some believe that a woman of faith cannot do. And so I think that's just kind of a limitation in part of what brought the subject up, what brought up that particular debate.
There's a, you know, a lot of debate right now. Again, we've talked hit on this already, but let me just ask this question, then I'll ask some follow-up questions. So you're a part of the Conservative Baptist Network, part of the steering council. Tell us kind of what went into being a part of it. I think I saw something where you said, an interview where you said, I didn't found it, but I'm happy to be a part of it. Tell us kind of why happy to be a part of it, and then I'll ask some follow-up questions from that.
Sure. Well, your memory on that is correct. I didn't found it. I did not start it. But I minister primarily throughout the Southeast, and I realize that is a subculture in and of itself to a large degree. But I dare say, at least figuratively, everywhere I go, and I think your listeners understand everywhere doesn't always mean everywhere, but what feels like everywhere that I go and I preach, serving at key levels in state convention life and national convention life, I would hear pastors who have concerns about various things within the life of the convention, and for that reason, they had disengaged. I'm never going back to another state convention. I'm never going to another SBC. We've stopped giving through the cooperative program. We've decreased. We've disengaged. We've negatively designated. We're escrowing. I hear these conversations at what I believe is a widespread level. I was sharing with my own state exec at that time, and we were discussing whether or not, and he was hearing the same things. We were debating as to whether or not we would call it widespread or epidemic. This was before COVID, so nobody was using pandemic at that point.
Right.
But in the present case, these kind of concerns being either widespread or epidemic, if that's the argument we're having, which is the better word, both of those, pardon me, certainly reflect that there's a challenge that we have. And the pastors that I hear from on a regular basis kind of have one foot out the door and one foot on a denominational banana peel. And so I saw the Conservative Baptist Network as just an opportunity to say to those pastors on that end of the spectrum of SBC life, stay involved, stay invested, stay engaged in what God is doing through the Southern Baptist Convention. You do have a voice. An annual meeting of the Southern Baptist Convention, I contend, is the most democratic deliberative body anywhere in the world. And a volunteer pastor of a church that may never run over 20 has the same vote and the same voice as the biggest name of a mega church or an entity head once you get registered as a messenger.
That's right.
So when someone says, I don't have a voice or nobody cares what I think, that may be your perspective, but we have to be honest that that's not reality. There are logistical challenges for a lot of our pastors and leaders to get to the annual meeting. But once you get there, you have the same vote and the same voice as anybody else. So I affiliated with the Conservative Baptist Network because I wanted to provide help to an organization that I thought could keep what I believe to be thousands of pastors and churches across the SBC engaged in the life of the convention. My desire is not to say, okay, if we put it on a spectrum, is not to say, okay, everybody in the Southern Baptist Convention needs to believe this. I've already indicated I've got members of my own church that don't agree with every jot and tittle of my own doctrinal perspective. But to say, don't leave, because I don't want anybody who can rally around the Baptist faith and message or something that's closely aligned with it, I don't want any of those brothers or sisters or congregations to withdraw from the Southern Baptist Convention.
Thank you for listening to the Baptist 21 podcast. To learn more about us, visit us at our website, baptist21.com. Also, please be sure to subscribe, rate, review, and share this podcast with others. It would really help us out. If you ever have thoughts or ideas for future interviews, please reach out to us at our email, baptist21@gmail.com. Again, thanks for listening to the podcast.